Hi, this is Dee Blick. Welcome to Lead Well, Live Well for UK Health Radio. Hello and welcome to Lead Well, Live Well with me, Dee Blick, for UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station. Thank you for joining us. It's lovely to have your company. Now, in the studio today, we have an extraordinary guest, Lucy Pitts. This is a woman who has built a media empire almost single-handedly, based on her love of walking, of exploring Sussex, and her talent as a writer. I mean, just to give you an idea, her online magazine alone averages 3 million readers, and her website attracts 40,000 monthly visitors. Now, I'm going to be talking about this later, but for now, a warm welcome, Lucy. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here.
And you're my second guest. Well, say you're my first guest, because the first show was just me, but you are my very first guest on Lead Well, Live Well.
Super privileged, really am.
So I just want to really start, because I know you are this kind of iconic publisher, but you didn't start out as an iconic publisher, did you? Your career was very different.
Absolutely. Although as a teenager, I always wanted to be either an international show jumper or a journalist. I actually ended up being a barrister, and I practiced law for nearly 15 years as the first part of my career.
Wow. I mean, what made you go into studying law?
Do you know what? It was a combination of my parents being quite dismissive about the idea of a journalism degree and thinking I had to do a degree that was useful, whatever I decided to do. So I did a law degree, and I got to the end of that and I thought, gosh, there's lots of people with a law degree. What can I do to elevate it? So I went to bar school. And after that, sort of the rest is history, really. Loath to say I fell into it, because it was quite hard to get a position in chambers, but I sort of got on the treadmill, and it naturally, one thing followed the other.
Gosh, I mean, what was life like as a barrister? Is it like you see on the TV programmes? Is it just really hard slog, then appearing in court? What was it like? Paint a picture of your life in that period.
Gosh, it's not as glamorous as it looks on TV, particularly if you're not in the corporate world. I was doing the heady combination of criminal work, family work and employment law. And certainly at the junior end, that is a lot of very early mornings. You go to court all around the country. So although my chambers was based in London and I lived in Sussex, I could be in court in Hull, in the West Country, anywhere around London. So you're up early getting to court. You've often got a lot to carry, because back then, pre-digital era, we had heavy files and books and text and your wig and your gown. I had a little suitcase I used to take with me to court. Long days, you know, you get to court for 9, you'd spend an hour or two with the client, a whole day in court, and then travel back and you just do the whole thing again the next day. So it was hard work. There were moments that were great fun, and there were moments that were utterly hideous, but I guess that's the same of any career.
I mean, how long does it take you to train as a barrister?
Well, I did a 3-year law degree, then a 1-year bar course to qualify as a barrister, and then I did what was called back then pupillage, which can last. You have to do a minimum of 12 months, but I think mine was 18 months in the end. So the first 6 months is literally just shadowing another barrister. And then the second 6 months, you start doing little cases of your own to get that experience on your feet. And then you're good to fly.
I find that astonishing. You put all that. I mean, it must have been a huge thing for you mentally to walk away from a career where you've put so much energy into studying. You were clearly successful at what you did, and we'll talk about why you became a copywriter, but I'm just intrigued to know what made you decide to walk away from it.
Well, the long version is, although I loved what I did, I subconsciously always felt like I was wearing somebody else's clothes. It didn't quite fit. It wasn't quite me. But I was sort of at the top of my game at the time I left, and at a pivotal moment when I could go on and become a judge and start taking more senior work, I was pretty much heading up the family team. But then I had three children in 2.5 years. There's no twins in there. They are each a year apart. They're now 20, 19, 18. And the bar back then, and I hope it's changed, simply wasn't set up for somebody with young children. It wasn't a possibility.
Gosh, so I guess I was thinking, I talk a lot about forks in the road, where we sometimes find ourselves at that fork in the road and taking the next decision, which might be completely contrary to what we have done previously. But it turns out to be our saving grace and perhaps the best decision that we've made. And I want to talk now about, obviously, a subject that's close to my heart as a writer, but what appealed to you about copywriting as a career? Because that's quite a big jump, going from being a barrister to being a copywriter. So tell me about that.
Yeah, that was pretty much a practical decision. Obviously, I'd always loved writing. I'd wanted to be a journalist. That had been a big part of my teenage years. I left the bar thinking I had no transferable skills. And, you know, that's a message I'm always keen to convey to other people. You've got more transferable skills than you realise. And then I sat there with these three small children, knowing that I needed and wanted to work, and thought, what on earth can I do from home? And copywriting was one of a very limited number of options. So I paid for a course on a credit card, because I had no funds at the time, and started my diploma and just took it from there.
I find that extraordinary. So it's like you took a leap of faith, and obviously I've seen the quality of your work, and because we are both writers, we are really intimately connected to the written word. And you're such a talented writer. And I look at my career, that I started writing at the age of 8. I just loved writing. But I would hazard a guess that your talent as a writer was always within you, and the copywriting course brought that out. It wasn't just a transactional case of I'm going from being a barrister to a copywriter. There was within you that talent to write.
Yeah, I think I've always been a writer, as I said. Legally, when you're practicing law, there is quite a lot of writing involved, but it's fairly structured and clinical, as it needs to be. But that's a really important part of copywriting, of course. What I had to bring out with the training that I did was the more creative side. And I remember at the time thinking, these marketeers, they speak a different language to me. I spoke law. I still speak law. And I remember thinking, all these expressions and terms, somebody said something about their marketing collateral. And I thought, what on earth are they talking about? Mm. And I realized I had to learn a whole new language in a different industry.
Yeah.
It was more natural than I thought it was, transitioning from clinical law to more creative writing.
I understand that completely. Give me, before we get to the break, we've got a couple of minutes. Could you fill in the gaps between, you know, starting a copywriting business and then founding this huge media brand? What happened? Because you didn't just think, right, copywriting course, tick, client work ticked, I'm now going to start a huge media brand with millions of readers to a magazine. There was obviously a route, as we all do, that you invariably took. So just paint a little picture of the gaps between done the course, open for business, and then this iconic brand.
Yeah, I suppose there was one pivotal event, and that was that my husband and I bought a derelict watermill in France in 2010. And as part of the renovation and the work, I was looking at ways to make money out of it, and rent it out, etc. So I contacted a magazine called The Good Life France. They were fairly young at the time as an organization, but I hit it off with the editor immediately and started writing for her. And that writing was more travel orientated. I was writing about the area in which our house was, the process of renovating a house. And that kind of sparked something. And I got on really well with her. She really liked my writing. I started doing more and more. I started going on press trips for her to France. And gradually, as my experience built, took a bigger and bigger role within that organisation. So that was kind of the start of the journey. And also a realisation that copywriting also wasn't my ultimate purpose. It wasn't giving me a great deal of joy. It was paying the bills, but it wasn't necessarily bringing me the joy that I think as we get older, we want a bit more purpose out of what we're doing. So it was those two combined events that sparked what turned into quite a journey.
I love that, because certainly with my life, I agree, it's often an event which sparks an interest and then you go on this brand new career path, which is just amazing. So stay with me. We're going to have a short break now. Then after the break, I'm going to get Lucy talking about the brand she's founded, Sussex Exclusive, and painting a lovely picture for us.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Lead Well, Live Well with me, Dee Blick. And in the studio today, I've got Lucy Pitts, a copywriter extraordinaire and media founder. So welcome back, Lucy. And let's talk now about Sussex Exclusive. Go into a bit of detail about how did it come to life? Because it's just such a huge, hugely popular site now and magazine, but there's a lot of work. And you, what fascinates me, I guess, is that all your successes you've accomplished almost single-handedly. You've not employed search engine specialists and web gurus. You've kind of just gone out there and put the hard yards in. So talk to us about Sussex Exclusive.
Sussex Exclusive is absolutely my reason for being. It's given me great purpose, and I hope when I depart this mortal coil, it will be my legacy. It came about post-COVID. I had, by that stage, been working as deputy editor at the Good Life France magazine, and I'd been editor for a few years of a local print magazine, which collapsed as a result of COVID. And somebody suggested to me that I launch my own magazine about Sussex, and I'm not very good at saying no, and I probably was quite naive, and I thought, yeah, why not? And somebody said, will you just do West Sussex? I was like, no, we'll do the whole of Sussex. It's not that big. And of course, I've come to realise since that it is quite a big county when you factor in East and West Sussex. So we started more or less 5 years ago today with nothing, literally nothing. I had an empty website with tumbleweed sort of blowing around the pages and no budget and no marketing collateral. So I just thought, right, well, how do we do this? So I took all the experience I had from the Good Life France and elsewhere and just started getting out there. I knew quite a lot about SEO, search engine optimization, from my copywriting. So that's at the absolute heart of all the writing that we do. And just got out there. And as I got out there exploring, and I think there was a part of the COVID factor was that I think we all realized that we had to explore our own backyard a bit more. And I'm an adventurer at heart. And I knew during COVID that if I didn't get out and do something, even if it was within my own mile, I would go crazy. So there was that element of let's explore and discover our own backyard. I'd always believed when I wrote about France, I used to say to myself, gosh, I wish we had all this history and landscape and food in Sussex. And I slowly realised that we have, in fact, got it and absolutely found my purpose. And the more I explore, the more I am delighted by Sussex and the more secrets it offers up.
I think that's a great answer. And what you and I share messages regularly throughout the day. And I'm always astonished that there's a message coming in at 5 or 6 in the morning and you're maybe 50 miles away, or you're walking through a forest, or you're photographing the sunset on top of a huge hill. And I guess I would say that your passion for exploring, for walking, for shining the light on local attractions and local businesses, that's kind of fueled your ambition, hasn't it?
Absolutely. That is the fuel behind it. Obviously, I have to think carefully about what other people are interested in, not just what I'm interested in. So we cover all sorts of things, food and drink, places to stay, business, health. But I think my passion I suspect my passion is what people find contagious, because I love it. There's nowhere that I've been that I think, God, I hate this place. Even the grittiest towns, and we have got a few gritty towns, I love them. I get genuinely excited when I go somewhere and find something new, find a bit of history. I call it dot joining, when you go to one place and you find something that connects it to somewhere completely different, or a different story, or a different article you were writing. And you start to realise that there's this invisible web across Sussex, with so many threads running between all the dots, and you can start to join those, and it's an endless and fascinating process.
And so how did, I know your passion and it's visible and clear to all, but how did you start? I think building a great website is one thing, and packing it with the most amazing, appealing, relevant, compelling content with beautiful photographs, which I know is something that you invest in. But there's that philosophy of build it and they. That's not always the case, is it? I know that as a marketer, when a business brings me in to do an MOT, that they've built something extraordinary, and then they're looking around and saying, well, gosh, where are all the customers, the clients? I've got this amazing business. And so there's still a gap between creating something extraordinary and then having the, in this case, it would be the viewers, the people clocking onto your website. So was that an organic process? Did it begin slowly but steadily, the visitors coming to the website?
Yeah, that was totally organic. We've never done any advertising or paid for any promotion. And it was gradual. You know, the first 2 years, they weren't necessarily slow. They were steady. I'm a great believer, first of all, in SEO, search engine optimization, but also just showing up every single day. And my web guy, who works for the Good Life France, said to me, you've got to write a weekly newsletter and you should have at least 4 articles in every one. And I remember at the beginning thinking, holy smoke, I'm never going to manage a weekly newsletter with 4 articles. But I've done it, and I've done it every single week in the 5 years since. And it's that element of just showing up that I think is really important. And I do believe, this is the second business I've founded, that the first 2 years are the foundation work. And often you work really, really hard during that period and you don't feel like you're making much progress. But when you look back later, you think, ah, that was really important. That was getting ourselves established. That was getting our name out there. That was doing the groundwork. And that's exactly what happened with my copywriting business. And it's more or less what's happened with Sussex Exclusive, because we're about 2.5 years in and then it started to really take off.
That is incredible. I mean, when did you realise, I look at your magazine and we talk about the stats that you average 3 million readers per magazine. It's an online magazine and you've got the website. That is no mean feat, given the amount of content. I mean, we're deluged with content. We're deluged with AI content. How on earth have you taken the brand to that level of is amazingness? Is that a word? It says the copywriter. Yeah. When did you realize that you were onto a winner in terms of reach and readers for the magazine and for the website?
It was a gradual process, and I have to give some credit to our publishing platform. We use a publishing platform called Yumpu. So when I set up the magazine on that, there's quite a lot of back-end work that I have to do with keywords again and descriptions and images. What I've learned is the front cover really makes a difference to how much engagement you get. But it's been a really gradual process. It's not something I ever take for granted. With each magazine, I kind of think, oh, they're going to like it. And there's that moment of dread when you hit publish and you think no one's going to look at it and nobody's going to view it. And I can be a little obsessive about checking the stats, because all our stats are transparent. They're available for other people to view on the magazine. So I'm often there checking them every hour just to make sure someone's read it.
You know, I understand that. I understand as a marketer, because I always believe you're only as good as your last client or your current project. And so although you dip back into all your experience and expertise and you've got these glittering trophies along the way, it's how am I doing now? It's the same for me even with books, that my latest book, I've still got that sense of low-lying anxiety and that hunger for it to be successful. And even though I've got the track record of the other books, it's like, oh, I really want this book to do well. And I sometimes think that that hunger and that desire, it keeps you on your toes. I think it keeps you sharp and it keeps you hungry, which is something that I think most entrepreneurs that I speak to, they never take anything for granted. So we're coming up to the next break, but don't go away, because after the break, I'm going to be talking to Lucy about imposter syndrome, about ADHD, and how, as women with ADHD, we often mask the symptoms.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to Lead Well, Live Well with me, Dee Blick, and I've got the lovely Lucy Pitts in the studio with me today. And I want to talk now about something that I think I've had, well, I think probably from the age of 21, which is imposter syndrome. And I didn't call it imposter syndrome at the time. It was only many years later when that label could be attached to it. But I remember that when I studied for my degree and I got a good degree, that for about a year afterwards, I had this recurring dream that I hadn't really got my degree, that somebody was going to whip the certificate away from me and say it had all been a ruse. And I realised then, as I've motored through life, that imposter syndrome is something that I've had to acknowledge and squash. Even things like, I remember when I got a book deal in China, I did not believe I'd got the book deal. I kept thinking, why me? Why would this publishing group choose my little book to translate it? And it was only when a big box of books arrived from China with this glorious yellow, red and black cover that I actually realised, gosh, yes, I had actually had a book that had been published overseas. And so, Lucy, I know you and I have spoken about this at length, imposter syndrome. How does it show up for you?
Gosh, yes, it's something I've lived with all my life. And actually, I know we're going to talk about ADHD, and I suspect the two are massively aligned, because I always felt like I never quite fitted in. So that possibly fueled it. I was always the dumb one in my family. I don't know whether they thought that. That was certainly my perception of it. And so I sort of started my career feeling inferior. And for years after I left the bar, I used to wake up at night after having a nightmare that someone had tapped me on the shoulder and said, "You're not qualified to be a barrister. What are you doing?" And I used to always check my insurance certificate. And even once I'd qualified as a copywriter, I physically wasn't able to describe myself as a writer for about 5 years. And there was a moment when I suddenly, it dawned on me, bearing in mind, I write professionally, so my output is enormous. Most writers might write 2,000 words a day. There are weeks when I write 10,000 words a day, every day of the week. You know, I can't afford not to be writing. And yet it took about 5 years for me to be able to say I'm a writer. And I think, yeah, I still have massive moments of imposter syndrome. Put me in a room full of editors and I think I'll probably shrivel and die. And I just have to sort of slap myself and get on with it.
Well, gosh, it's funny you said that about being a writer, that you're writing 10,000 words a day, but you often think, am I really a writer? And I get that tapping on the shoulder. I remember having that with the first book, that it was, I couldn't call myself an author. So when people said, "What do you do?" I couldn't even say I'm an author, because I thought, well, not really. I've written a book. It's a vanity publishing book. And it was only when my second book went viral and it really took off that I allowed myself to use the title author, but even now I can sort of be a bit cringy at saying it. And it's interesting, isn't it, that I wonder if having something like imposter syndrome, I think, I don't know if you're like this, but for me, it makes me work just that bit harder. And I remember at school that I always felt that I had to work harder than anybody else to accomplish what they had, which invariably meant that on some occasions I exceeded and won the prizes. But it was always that you've got to put a little bit extra in, which can be advantageous, but sometimes it can take its mental toll on you, can't it?
Yeah, I think for me, it manifests itself in a never ending desire for qualifications. I'm always trying to get another qualification because I sort of somehow think that that's going to justify me. And achievements. I'm always craving those achievements. I want to win an award. I want to do that. I want to do that. And yet when I succeed in them, I rarely say to myself, well done, now you've made it. I'm already looking and thinking, oh, yeah, but if only I'd got that award. And I'm always looking bigger. So there's always that slight dissatisfaction with what you've achieved.
I think that's really, I really identify with what you said there. And it also makes me realise the importance of surrounding ourselves with people who get us, who will advocate for us, and who will help us showcase our magnificence at times when we feel that, oh my goodness me, I just want to dive under the duvet today. I talk a lot about having great community, whether that community is one person who really gets you. And so I want us now to talk about ADHD, because you and I have spoken about this at length. And did you self-diagnose having ADHD, and how has the diagnosis helped you in running your life generally?
Well, my journey was a different one. Two of my three children have an ADHD diagnosis, and I suspect the third also has ADHD. We didn't bother getting a diagnosis. Both children were diagnosed quite late in their education. And without wishing to rant, were catastrophically failed by the education system. And for one of them, that had quite serious implications. And as a result, I went on quite a deep dive in terms of learning. I haven't got a diagnosis. I don't feel I need one. The deeper I dove, if that's a word, the more it was entirely evident to me that I also had ADHD. And in fact, it's a hereditary thing. And once you start to learn about it and you look at your family, for me, it made an awful lot of sense. I can see where it's come down the family line. It explains our family dynamics. Learning about it has really helped me. I get frustrated. I know there's a lot of people say that it's being overdiagnosed. And a lot of people will say, well, we're all on the spectrum. And that irritates me, because of course we're all on the spectrum. That's the point of the spectrum. But if you sit in the middle, life is quite comfortable. It's for those people that live on the fringes of that spectrum. And the further towards the fringes of the spectrum you are, the harder life gets. And of course, there are a lot of people being diagnosed. There's a lot of people with red hair, yellow hair, blue hair, pink hair, whatever, brown eyes, blue eyes. We are all different. We've been wrong to assume that everybody or the majority of people are neurotypical up until now. I should think there's a jolly healthy balance of neurotypical and non-neurotypical, and we're just beginning to recognise that. And it's made a massive difference in how I've learned to forgive myself for all those little things that you think, oh, why am I such an idiot? And then you think, actually, no, that's how I'm wired. It's why I never fitted in. And it's helped me, more importantly, it helped me parent, because I realised they weren't being deliberately difficult. Genuinely, this is how they are. But it's also helped me with other people. I think you start to get a bit of a radar when you know a bit more about it, and you spot signs in other people, and you think, oh, okay, you're not being deliberately difficult in how you're working with me. I understand why you're doing that. And I think I'm a more tolerant, better person.
Okay, so what I want to ask you, for the benefit of our listeners, because when you mentioned ADHD to me, I didn't have a clue what ADHD was. So what are some of the common signs that you may have ADHD? Because when you read the list to me, I actually thought you were having a bit of a joke with me and saying, this is your character, Dee, And then when I read it all, it made complete sense to me. But up until that point, it's a bit like I never thought I was an alcoholic until the day when I spoke to somebody and they told me all the signs of being an alcoholic. And it was like, wow, yeah, I really do fit that bill. So just briefly, can you share some of the signs of having ADHD?
Gosh, well, the first thing I'd say is that I think, certainly in my experience, and I'm not the expert and I don't pretend to be an expert, I'm only talking from the experience of me and my family, it's very different in boys and girls. Although, and I've got a girl and a boy with it, although what I notice with both of them, that at any given time, part of their body is moving. Even if that's only quite slight, you might just see that their knee is shaking or they're fidgeting with a finger, but they're always moving. For my son, sitting through a meal is almost impossible because he's up and he's down and he's up and he's down. So sitting in a classroom was really difficult for him because he was just fidgeting all the time. I remember the psychologist saying, does he run around a lot? I said, no, actually, he dances a lot. He just moves his body a lot all the time. For my daughter, it's very different. She also moves a lot all the time. For her, she never slept. From a baby, she never slept. And I mean never slept. We'd get maybe 1 hour sleep a night. And that, she never slept. She doesn't sleep now and she's 20. But all through the primary years, she'd get maybe 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night. And she would say it was like her brain running with all the tabs open at any given time. And I was amazed at that because I thought everybody's brain was like that. Because I've got probably 20 conversations going on in my head all the time at any given time. And then I realised that my husband only has one conversation going on in his head at any given time. I thought, what a nice place that would be. That must be so quiet. But there are so many different ways that it manifests itself. You know, we haven't got long enough, probably. Enormous energy, but also feelings of overwhelm. There's that executive functioning where you know what you've got to do, you just physically cannot bring yourself to do it. And I suppose one of the most poignant one parts of it for me is, I can't remember what it's called, rejection sensitivity dysmorphia, yeah. Which means if somebody criticizes you or gives you feedback, or even if they don't criticize you, but you think, you perceive that there's some sort of criticism, it literally cripples you. And you will only understand that if you have felt it yourself. It's a visceral physical reaction that you just kind of curl up and die inside. And I thought everybody had that, and apparently they don't. But if you've ever felt it, you'll know exactly what I mean.
That's really, really fascinating. It certainly helped me, and I've read up about it since then. And so we're coming into the closing minutes of the show today, and I can now flip the switch onto me. And so I'd love you to share your inspirational quote, and then you've got a question to ask me, and I don't have a clue what question you're going to ask me. So what's your quote?
Well, my inspirational quote is probably not, it feels a bit mundane, but it is just keep moving forward. And I apply that to all aspects of my life. I've had some big goals in my life. I never see them as big goals. I just see them as statements of fact. And I think if you just keep turning up and just, even if they're tiny steps, if you're taking little steps forward, you are making progress. And I also think that being reliable and consistent often goes a lot further than being super talented. You just got to turn up, be reliable, be professional, and keep taking little steps forward. Even on those days when you want to hide under the duvet, find the smallest, easiest task and do that, and you've moved yourself forward a little bit.
I like that. And that's something that we can all adopt, isn't it? That if we feel we've got this mountain to climb, it's like you don't have a mountain to climb. You can chip away at it, doing bits at a time. You can stop. You can look at the view. You can even go down a bit if you are in a state of temporary fear. But I so agree with that. And I think it's how I have to live my life, is just doing little incremental steps of progress. You've got, I love having a big vision, but if I focus too much on the big vision, I can panic. So just actually chipping away at it nicely. And I think also you feel so much better at the end of the day when you can look back at the momentous things, the little things that you've achieved that all add up to that bigger picture. So, yeah, I agree with that and I really like it. And what's your question for me?
Gosh, well, I hope this isn't too difficult. I ummed and ahed about this a lot. And I wondered if you have a secret weapon, whether it's a strategy or a marketing tool or a go-to technique, but some secret weapon that you pull out, I don't know, when needed, when something isn't going well, when you want to do something special. What's your secret weapon?
Gosh, that's a bit profound. I think there's two sides to that. There's the mental side, which is if I'm taking on a big project, then I have to really mentally prepare. But I would say that the secret weapon I have, because it's not always in big supply today, is curiosity. That I am a curious person. And so I began my career as a marketer asking questions, and I launched a series of workshops called Marketing MOTs. And I'd have clients coming in from all over the world, you know, literally flying in for spending a day with me. And I was curious. And my curiosity manifests itself as asking questions almost to the point of driving myself dotty, because I figure that if I ask lots of questions, I'm going to get to the root of the opportunity, to the root of the problem. And often when businesses were coming to see me in the very early days, they weren't coming skipping to the door. They were coming because they were baffled. Why is my marketing not working? What's happening? I've spent all this money. And it would have been so easy for me to jump to a conclusion, which is something that is in my nature, jumping straight to the solution. So without a shadow of a doubt, deploying that curiosity, asking lots and lots of questions. And then, as you said earlier about joining up the dots, when you were talking about Sussex Exclusive with the content and the overall story, I realized that when I began to join the dots up, which was pivoted on my curiosity, I then began to get the solutions for clients, which led on to me being very successful as a marketer. And it all began with that asking questions. And I think that to a certain extent today, we have lost that curiosity. And yet if you go into AI and ask about human development, what is one of the critical qualities for human development, what will come up is curiosity. So that's a brilliant question. And I'm so pleased I was able to answer it without falling apart and thinking, oh, eck.
And do you know what? Curiosity drives everything we do at Sussex Exclusive. Everywhere I go, I'm just curious. Why is that tree there? Why is that gravestone there? You know, curiosity is everything.
I love that. And so I'm now going to wrap up and just say thank you so much for joining me today, Lucy, for being my very first guest. It's been lovely to have your company, and I'm sure that I'll have you back on when I'm a bit further into the series. Thank you, Lucy. So that brings me to the end of today's show. I really hope you've enjoyed it, and please message me on LinkedIn or Facebook and tell me what you think and if you've got any questions. It's been lovely having your company. I hope you've identified with some of the things that we've shared, and that I, as I always say, celebrate your magnificence and always back yourself big time, because life is very precious and we owe it to ourselves to step out into the sunlight and embrace our circle of power. That's me, Dee Blick, on Lead Well, Live Well for UK Health Radio. Thank you. You've been listening to Lead Well, Live Well on UK Health Radio.